We've tried our best to work with 90 days. I'd like to see us have 90 days the first year and then go back to 120 days on the second year.
Mulling over the 90-day mandate for the state legislature. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 20th of December. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaskans push for ratifying the Strategic Arms Treaty.
And I think the military leaders' endorsement of the treaty is a significant fact that I think ought to be emphasized.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's almost time to file online for your PFD, and when you do, you can make an impact by sharing just a little with a cause you care about. Celebrate the arts, invest in education, shelter a homeless pet, lend a hand, or even make a wish come true when you pick, click, give to one of Alaska's nonprofits. Visit pickclickgive.org to decide how you will make Alaska better with a small gift from your PFD. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
As the first year of the 27th Alaska State Legislature draws near, the 90-day session approved by voters in 2006 is in danger of being modified by the politicians it was intended for. Prior to the 2008 session, legislators had 120 days to complete the people's business. Now, Senate President Gary Stevens of Kodiak said he would introduce legislation to modify the session length during at least one of the 2 years a legislature is comprised of.
But it has been a bit of a problem. I've sat on a resources committee. We've had to tell people who've come to testify, you've got 1 minute to testify. That's all you've got because we're near the end of 90 days and we have to move. So it's not really been fair. I think folks have not had a chance to have input into the legislature with 90 days. I'd like to see us consider, hopefully the public would not be too upset about this because we've tried our best to work with 90 days. I'd like to see us have 90 days the first year and then go back to 120 days on the second.
He says that would allow the legislators to deal with the backlog of bills that would otherwise expire if not addressed in the second year of the 2-year legislature. Former Fairbanks Representative Jay Ramris was a supporter of the 90-day session when he was in the State House. He would not say what he thought of Stevens' alternating year idea, but thinks the debate over any change will be lively.
It was introduced 24 times in 15 years to shorten the legislative session by statute, and it will be an interesting process to watch over a 2-year legislative session, and there will be champions of more time, and there will be those that bemoan that more time is not necessary, and that's what the state legislature is good for, is for a rousing discussion.
Voters approved the initiative in November 2006 by a margin of 3,843 votes, or just 1.6%. The 90-day limit went into effect with the start of the 2008 legislative session. While the legislature is required to abide by voter initiatives, they may change them after a 2-year waiting period. Several legislators earlier this year floated the idea of shortening the session. So far, Stephen says reaction from his colleagues has been positive.
I think everyone realizes that we've really been under the gun to try to get through everything in that second year, and that's one solution. Now, of course, realizing that the Constitution still allows us 120 days, so if we have to go over, we do, and I think this last year we went over by about 20 minutes, and that's constitutionally quite legal.
The new legislative session for 90 days kicks off on Tuesday, January 18th. Senator Lisa Murkowski broke ranks with most Republicans this weekend to support repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the policy that bans gays serving openly in the military, and the DREAM Act to let young illegal immigrants earn citizenship through college or military service. Her votes lined up with those of Alaska's Democratic Senator Mark Begich. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
It was a working weekend in the U.S. Senate, which cast a historic vote Saturday to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell in a tally of 65 to 31. The House passed the bill last week, so it now awaits the president's signature to become law. Senator Murkowski and seven other Republicans joined with Democrats, like Alaska's Mark Begich, to support the repeal. Murkowski put out a statement saying that military leaders have made a compelling case that they can implement a repeal and that it's better for Congress to act than the courts. Begich hailed the vote as the end of what he called an outdated, discriminatory, and harmful policy. Last week, Congressman Don Young voted against repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The DREAM Act, which would give young illegal immigrants in the U.S. the chance to become legal if they go to college or serve in the military, failed in the Senate Saturday. Begich voted to open up debate on it, as did Murkowski, one of only three Republicans to do so. Five Democrats voted against it. Murkowski says she supports the DREAM Act because children are not to blame for their parents' decision to enter the U.S. illegally, and that for many of them, America is the only home they've ever known, and that the country can give them opportunity. But despite her vote to move forward with the DREAM Act, the Republican senator chastised Democrats for not allowing room for debates or amendments. The clock is counting down on the lame duck session, with Christmas less than a week away, and there's still more to do. The White House wants to see the new START treaty with Russia over nuclear weapons passed. Some Republican critics have raised concerns that the agreement would hamper missile defense efforts, but President Obama reached out to Senate leaders over the weekend to say it would not. Senator Murkowski has not yet weighed in on how she will vote. Also waiting in the wings is a bill that would create a health fund for 9/11 responders who got sick after working at the World Trade Center site in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks. Republicans had concerns about the price tag and how it would be paid for, but the costs had been whittled down, and New York Democrats say they may have enough votes to move forward. Every day that it takes to hammer out details is another day closer to the end of the year and the end of this session of Congress. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
The U.S. Senate continued work tonight on the Strategic Arms Reduction or START Treaty. Three amendments were defeated that would have changed it. A final vote is expected this week, and President Obama today expressed confidence that it would happen. President Obama and Russian President Dmitry Medvedev signed the START Treaty in April. It would reduce the number of strategic nuclear warheads both nations could possess, but it must be ratified by the Russian Parliament and a two-thirds vote of the U.S. Senate. Going into the debate, Alaska senators heard a strong message from home. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander reports.
In a nuclear war, there are no victors, there are only victims.
The U.S. Senate should vote to ratify the START Treaty. That's the message from several well-known Juneau constituents to both Senators Mark Begich and Lisa Murkowski. Begich is already a yes vote, but those at a recent video conference with staff from both senators' offices are concerned how Murkowski will vote. Juneau Mayor Bruce Botello, Assemblyman Bob Dahl, League of Women Voters President Carolyn Brown, and Catholic Deacon Charles Rohrbacher had hoped to talk to the senators themselves. Instead, they were told by staff their concerns will be noted. The meeting came just after a Senate vote to allow debate on the treaty. Begich voted yes, and Murkowski originally said nay, then changed her vote in favor of debate. Political watchers say that makes her stance on the treaty iffy. The Juneau Group hopes it means she will support final ratification. The new START Treaty is backed by all U.S. military leaders. Assemblyman Bob Dahl, a 30-year veteran of the U.S. Navy, says that should speak volume to Republican senators who oppose it.
And I think the military leaders' endorsement of the treaty is a significant fact that I think ought to be emphasized.
Senator Begich is on the Armed Services Committee. He says more than 20 classified and public hearings have been held on the treaty in the last 7 months. Begich says concern that would hurt the missile defense system at Fort Greely is a red herring.
Secretary Gates, I've asked Secretary Clinton, I've asked the Missile Defense Agency Director, the former Strategic Command General. I mean, you name the people, I've asked them in front of the committee, and every time I ask them very specifically, how does this affect Alaska in the sense of the Fort Greely missile defense system?
And every time, he says, the answer is the same.
It doesn't negatively impact Alaska at all. In other words, what we're doing there and finishing the development of the missile defense system, continue to operate it, can continue to go on.
After the Juneau Group spoke to her staff, Senator Murkowski rejected this reporter's request for an interview, sending a message that she is still reviewing the treaty. That's what the Juno group came away with from their video conference last week. As the meeting was breaking up, Dr. Carolyn Brown of the League of Women Voters put it this way.
She needs to get lots of mail from us quickly.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has called for ratification before Christmas. Begich says he believes it's possible and that several Republicans will join with Democrats to vote in favor. Ratification requires 67 votes. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, anticipating tonight's blood moon.
Just as we see the sun when it's below the horizon lighting the sky, at sunrise, the sky is a reddish color.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future. ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, has been asked to administer the new temporary federal insurance program that allows individuals with a qualifying pre-existing condition and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months an opportunity to purchase health insurance. Capacity is limited, so contact an insurance broker or ACHEA immediately. More information at achia.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
James Kendall has been selected to serve as the acting director of the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, Regulation, and Enforcement's Alaska Outer Continental Shelf Region. Kendall takes over his new duties beginning January 1st. The current director of the Alaska region, John Gall, is retiring after 41 years. Kendall now serves as the chief of the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management's Environmental Division, where he was responsible for overseeing the Bureau's $30 million Applied Environmental and Socioeconomic Research Program. Before that, he was head of the Bureau's Environmental Sciences Section for the Gulf of Mexico. Many people around the world will become amateur stargazers tonight, looking up at the sky to witness one of the most unique astrological events of the year. KDLG's Adam Kane has the story.
Beginning at approximately 9:33 p.m. tonight, the Earth will move into the path between the Sun and the Moon, creating a total lunar eclipse. The Moon will be completely immersed in the shadow as the Moon continues on its rotation around the Earth for about an hour between 10:41 and 11:53 p.m. Palmer Bailey is a former astronomy professor and now produces a weekly radio show called Planetary Matters. He says that tonight's eclipse will cause the moon to change colors.
It will look quite dark. There'll be a little bit of illumination. You'll still be able to see it. That full eclipse will last for quite a long time, about an hour and 12 minutes. During the time that it's in there, the only light that will be illuminating the moon will be that which is refracted through the Earth's atmosphere. Just as we see the sun when it's below the horizon lighting the sky, at sunrise, the sky is a reddish color because the light that comes through the atmosphere is refracted back down. It's bent by the atmosphere as it goes through a little bit.
Bailey goes on to say that sunlight is bent around the Earth because of the lighter atmosphere that hangs above the heavier atmosphere. That combination, he says, will likely cause the moon to appear the dark red color that sometimes is seen during a sunrise or a sunset.
What is happening on the moon, the only light that's getting there is that which is refracted through the atmosphere. So all of the sunsets and all of the sunrises at that moment all around the entire world are refracting some of the light onto the moon. And thus it'll be fairly dark, but there'll be a reddish color to it. This effect is called a blood moon.
Lunar eclipses are not entirely rare. However, Bailey says that the eclipse occurring tonight and lasting into tomorrow morning is unique in its timing.
Tomorrow, December 21st at 2:30 p.m., the sun will reach its most southerly point on the ecliptic. That's the path that the sun takes across the sky. So it's been moving south for the last 6 months. And what that does, of course, it puts more shadow of the Earth on where we are, and thus we get shorter days. So that's the winter solstice. At that point, the sun will reach its most southerly point and begin then a six-month journey back to the north. So all within 24 hours here, we've got a total lunar eclipse, a good one, and we have the winter solstice within that same 24 hours.
There are generally a couple lunar eclipses during each calendar year. Bailey says that a telescope isn't necessary to see tonight's eclipse. However, binoculars could make it more enjoyable.
You don't need, certainly don't need a telescope. You can see the moon very well without that. Binoculars always make the moon more exciting when you look at it that way. But it's basically the hour before midnight, from about 10:40 till about 11:53, technically. Go out there, certainly by 11 o'clock, and take a look at the moon, if the clouds will allow it. And you can see an amazing effect, or a simple thing like a shadow.
At about 11:53 p.m. tonight, the upper edge of the moon will begin to move out of the Earth's shadow, and by 1 a.m., the moon will be completely out of the shadow once again. In Dillingham, I'm Adam Kane.
The union that represents most of Petersburg's city workers is now preparing for a potential strike vote. Negotiators for the Petersburg Municipal Employees Association say they still hope to avoid a strike, but the union and the city have remained at odds over wages and leave time since contract talks started last February. The employees' old contract expired in March, and with little progress since then, the union is now asking the state to clarify which employees would be allowed to strike if they take that step. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
Petersburg Municipal Employees Association officials expect their membership will take a strike vote. That's unless the city of Petersburg comes up with an offer the union considers reasonable. Earlier this fall, the union's membership overwhelmingly rejected a city proposal for a status quo contract with no wage increases. Angie Parker is the Southeast Field Representative for the Alaska Public Employees Association, which includes the Petersburg Union.
We would be willing to sit down and negotiate a reasonable offer, but they've given us what they say is their last, best, and final offer. So we're just at that point of trying to get the, you know, determine who can and can't strike before we can vote.
Only those workers who are allowed to strike can vote on a strike. Parker believes a majority of Petersburg's 70 or so workers are generally allowed to strike under state law. That includes cashiers, clerks, and other administrative staff, as well as public works, sanitation, water, and wastewater employees. The law specifically prohibits strikes by so-called Class 1 workers, which include hospital, police, fire protection, and jail staff. Instead, if mediated negotiations fail, the city has to settle contract disputes with Class 1 employees through a process called interest arbitration. That's where a judge hears the case and makes a legally binding decision on the contract. The union maintains there are more Class 1 workers than the city does, so the union is petitioning the Alaska Labor Relations Board to settle that disagreement before there can be a strike vote. According to Parker, the union had proposed going to arbitration for all workers in the union rather than just for Class 1 employees.
We could say, let's just include all these employees and take an interest arbitration, and then an arbitrator will determine for everyone what, you know, this contract question. And then we would avoid a strike and we would have an independent arbitrator decide it.
But the city rejected arbitration for all worker classes. City Manager Scott Hahn calls the situation unfortunate, but with declining sales tax, past deficit spending, and other financial concerns, he maintains the city cannot afford a wage increase.
It's not merely what are we spending this year, but where are we going to then be anchored in all future years. So the decision to do that is it's kind of foolish to do that when you know your funds are dwindling and your economy is shaky and this is not the time to be doing that. So you have to stick to your guns and have the integrity and to make the right decisions for the future.
According to the Alaska Labor Relations Agency, the city has filed an objection to the union's petition to determine which workers can strike. The city's also asked for a hearing on that matter, and that means it could be a while before the agency issues a decision and the union could move forward with a strike vote. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
And by
the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering access to online courses from any location. Spring semester starts January 20th. Information at distance.uaf.edu.
A 31-year-old Kodiak man has been acquitted of second-degree murder after a jury returned a not guilty verdict. But the jury did convict Sean D. Summerall of felony assault, and he will likely remain incarcerated until he is sentenced in the spring. Summerall was one of two men accused in the 2008 beating death of 41-year-old Daryl Cavanis of Kodiak. The jury spent late Thursday, all day Friday, and a couple of hours today deliberating before returning its verdict shortly after 10 a.m. Neither the prosecutor nor defense attorneys that had argued the case were present for the reading of the verdict, but heard the decision through a conference call. Present in the court was Josh Fitzgerald, a court-appointed attorney representing Summerall. He would not speculate on the length or type of sentence Summerall faces when sentenced. It was on the night of January 22, 2008, when Cavanis was found beaten unconscious in an apartment on Natalia Way in the city of Kodiak. He died about a week later in an Anchorage hospital. An earlier indictment against Summerall was thrown out after a judge ruled prosecutors had presented hearsay as evidence. Charges were refiled against him, and the murder trial began December 6th. Also indicted is 31-year-old Joshua Erickson, who faces a charge of second-degree murder. Prosecutors had decided to try the men separately, and that trial is scheduled to begin in March. Wind power has arrived in Sitka. Mount Edgecombe High School and the U.S. Coast Guard have collaborated on the installation of a wind turbine on the Sitka Channel alongside the cutter Maple. The project has been 7 months in the making. It is the third turbine in Alaska installed under the National Wind for Schools program run by the U.S. Department of Energy. KCAW's Robert Woolsey attended the ribbon-cutting ceremony on a recent breezy afternoon.
When the wind is blowing like it is today, it seems like there is no better idea than a wind turbine. By mutual consent, the crowd of 30 or so gathered by the Maple Dock to cut the ribbon on the 60-foot-high turbine are huddled against the cold like penguins. We are here because Matt Hunter, a math and physics teacher at Mount Edgecombe High School, pulled together all the threads of officialdom and sponsorship needed to make something like this happen.
Today it's been putting, I think, an average of 500 watts out, so half a kilowatt, but it's already produced 7 kilowatt hours today, which works out to be 56 cents or something, you know. But it's not meant to be a moneymaker as much as a learning tool for us and for the Coast Guard.
On top of the SkyStream turbine is a 4-inch antenna, which is transmitting data back to Mount Edgecombe High School. And from there, it is uploaded to the Idaho National Laboratory, where it is available to the world. At 2.4 kilowatts, this project is a fraction of the size of commercial-scale turbines, but it is the real thing. The Department of Energy's Wind for Schools program is about training the next generation of wind engineers.
It's a full curriculum for all grade levels, and they build small model turbines in the classroom, and you hook them up to a digital meter, and you can tell how much power comes out and change the blade angles and change the blade designs and try to figure out what the best design is. So that's a project I'm planning on doing in physics next year, and hopefully we can do it in the physical science course that all the kids take as well.
In a stiff breeze, the turbine can generate up to 2,000 watts, enough to run a microwave, a clothes dryer, or a hot water heater. It is the second IPP, or independent power producer, to be connected to Sitka's electrical system in as many months. A private homeowner installed a solar system in November. When the Maple is away, the turbine will be delivering power into the Sitka grid. The Sitka Electric Department contributed $5,000 to the project. Director Chris Bruton says he'll gain insight into the feasibility of wind power.
Well, that's why I'm really a supporter of getting this out, because we'll be able to collect very good data, actual production data, and be able to compare what the cost is per kilowatt hour to generate it versus solar or hydro or diesel and everything else. So in the future, when folks want to, you know, this probably has great applications for some of the islands without power and other sorts of remote locations. I don't think we'll ever get there on a utility-grade scale, simply because we just don't have enough consistent wind. But collecting this data is going to really help us make a good argument about one way or the other.
This is the third turbine installed in the Wind for Schools program in Alaska, and the second for the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard donated the $8,000 device as well as its twin in Juneau. The agency has also pushed ahead on planning for conversion to biomass heating at its facilities in Southeast. Steve Rainey heads the Guard's civil engineering office in Juneau. He says this kind of initiative pays back the Coast Guard in a couple of ways.
One is we get the energy, so it helps the Coast Guard meet some of the president's and the national renewable energy goals that are there for the Coast Guard as a whole. But probably more importantly, because this doesn't, it doesn't generate a whole heck of a lot of electricity in terms of what we need. More than anything, I think, is it's the goodwill in the community and the cooperation and the partnerships. And, you know, the Coast Guard is trying to lead in a lot of renewable energy areas. And so this is kind of a good step forward in that direction and gives us a notoriety, I guess, if you will, in that perspective.
The nuts and bolts experience could also prove useful to the Guard. Most lighted buoys today are powered by solar panels. Sudhi Hargis, an energy program specialist with the Guard, says there are practical applications for wind power in the agency's mission.
This is allowing us to learn about renewable energy so that we can then implement it in other harder-to-reach areas. So, for example, the distress radios that are, we have more than 50 distress radios in Alaska that carry the distress signals for vessels offshore. And we helicopter fuel, propane fuel, up to those mountaintops at an exorbitant cost and risk to life. And so what we'd like to do is we'd like to implement systems like wind systems where it's a safer system, we're not risking people's lives, and we're saving the people of the country money.
The Coast Guard is also big on the educational component of the turbine, which is really what this boils down to. According to the Renewable Energy Alaska Project, which put $1,000 towards construction of the turbine, there are already over 90 commercial-scale wind turbines generating power in villages in Alaska, villages where most of Mount Edgecombe High School students come from.
I guess it's time to cut the ribbon and make this official. Awesome! Yay!
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jay Barrett and Jacob Resnick in Kodiak, Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, Adam Kane in Dillingham, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, providing insight on statewide business and government issues. There's more information online at akbizmag.com. The Federal Aviation Administration sets rules for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, and when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.